Signward State Ministry, Queensland. We're at the Ashgrove Baptist Church, Friday morning, the 18th of January, 1991, for the week-long biblical conference with guest speaker Dr. Haddon Robinson from Denver, Colorado, U.S. of A. This is the last day of the conference, and this is tape number 2 of the day.
One last dying gasp before we leave. I'd be glad to try to interact with that. Yes.
I'm I'm not a preacher, and I don't do
many sermons, but what's a good way to start to get yourself going? You know, I know we've got all this material here, but because you don't do much of it, you know,
okay.
Is there any areas we can...
Let me give you a very quick sort of popular way of... it's almost a formula. And... you may find it helpful. That is, if you're going to ask, how do you put a sermon together or talk together? Let me just give you a quick outline that may be another way of coming at what we've been doing, okay? If you, we have talked about outlines in terms of logical outlines, Roman numerals, A's, 1's, 2's. And that's important because it's important to measure your sermon logically. There's a whole together. You'll never be able to preach it without notes unless there's coherence in the sermon. But another way of looking at this whole thing is from the point of view of the audience. That is asking the question, how do listeners listen to sermons? If you can get into the person's mind as to how they listen, then... you have a better chance of getting through to them. So let me just give you a quick outline that talks about the preaching as listeners like it, and it may be of some help. If you anticipate how a congregation feels when you get up to preach, imagine the situation. The service has begun. They have had... praise choruses if you're in a progressive church. They've sung 3 hymns if you're another kind of church. They have had, maybe the scripture reading, the offering. So, 25 minutes has gone by and you get up. If you were to survey the audience as to how they feel, fact is they're a little bit bored and they have a suspicion you're going to make matters worse. So if you could survey them, the response that they would give is a united ho-hum. The question then is, how do you deal with this? Well, if you can picture yourself being on an island, and picture your congregation being on another island, your island is inhabited by the Jebusites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, all that kind of thing. The audience in front of you, their world is inhabited by Australian rules football or cricket scores, or by a daughter that has left home in anger, or about a job that's not going well. I mean, that's their world, okay? So I've got to somehow, when I get up, overcome this ho-hum. And what I need to do, if I'm going to overcome it, is to light a fire. And so, if you light a fire, which is not a very good fire here, what I want to get is their attention. So what I do is start with an interesting statement. As we said, the first 25 words, first couple of sentences, are among the most important sentences that you utter. If I get attention, the second question that the audience asks is, why bring that up? And what I do in response to that is to build a bridge between my world and their world. I've gotten their attention, but now I've got to build a bridge. And when I do, what I am doing is surfacing or creating a need. A early on, I've got to show them that if they will stick with me for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever I'm going to do, that what they will hear will touch some kind of need in their lives. The more personal the need, the more immediate the need, the stronger will be their desire to listen to what I have to say. If I get the audience from their island over to my island, I want to show them my treasure. So their question is, what's your big idea? That is, I created a need. How do you expect to meet that? And what I do is to show them the treasure, show them the box. That is, I state my idea. We've talked a bit about inductive preaching. If you're starting out, forget it. Just do something deductive. Don't play point, who's got the point. Don't play a shell game with the audience. See if they can find out what you're talking about. When Napoleon sent out his messengers, he had only three instructions. Be clear, be clear, be clear. Well, then state it. Tell them. Okay. When you have dealt with your big idea, stated it, then you want to open this treasure chest and get down to specifics. And so people ask, for instance, and what you want to do is be specific and concrete. You do it by your wording, do it by your illustrations, but you make an abstract statement and people are saying, for instance, for example. So as you're developing anything, that's what you want to do. And then if you have developed your body of material doing that, the final question an audience asks is, so what? What difference does this make? And what you're going to do is to suggest an action. In other words, if they go back over this bridge, back into their world, you're going to try, as they go back, you're going to try to give them something they can do, hopefully within the next 24 hours, to put what you're saying into practice. Sometimes you find that difficult, but you will most often find it possible if you think about it. After you've worked with a message logically, if you go through and ask, I met the ho-hum? Have I answered the question? Why bring that up? Have I stated my idea? Is it clear? Have I developed it by the use of, for instance, for example? Have I met that, as people ask it? And then, so what? What difference does it make? Do they have any idea what they could do as a result of what I have said? On my desk in my office, I have a piece of poetry. I guess it's poetry. It says, as Tommy Snooks and Betty Brooks were leaving church on Sunday, said Tommy Snooks to Betty Brooks, tomorrow will be Monday. That has got to be the ultimate low of social conversation. But for a preacher preparing a message, it's the ultimate high. Because if what I teach on Sunday doesn't make any difference in Monday morning's world, then I am not preaching to change lives. So tomorrow is Monday. When do you preach on Sunday? And the question is, what could happen on Monday as a result of what I do? You take that and use it as a little formula. It's not the whole of the thing. But if you say, all right, I'm going to design my talk so that I follow these five questions. The first two are what you'd normally put into your introduction. The middle two are what you'd normally put into what you think of as the body of the message, and the last you'd put into your conclusion. Preachers who are sophisticated will handle this in a lot of different ways, but if you just take that formula, fit what you have to say to the formula, the dog hunts. It'll work for you because it is a psychological outline that relates what you're saying to the way an audience thinks. So it's a long answer to a short question. Would you put a nickel in, you get a whole recording. But I have found that a helpful little thing, often when I'm working with lay people. It gives them a way of quickly grasping some of the stuff we had talked about. Yes?
Had two questions. One is, on the first day you said that, it was something like this, you said that sermons are now harder than they were any time since the second century, or it's now harder to preach. I think it was something to do with the visual age. I guess I just put that down on the pad. Is that what you're saying, that because of we're such a visual age now with the whole, you know,
yeah,
the whole media, is that why it's so hard now?
What I was really trying to drive at is that we have had a certain way of preparing sermons from the second century on that was governed by Greco-Roman rhetoric. That was one in which you had a proposition, you just introduced the proposition, and then you took it apart. And wherever you look at preaching, at least in the Western world, that's what they did. Well, I would argue that today, that Greco-Roman model is all right, but because we have become a visual, story-oriented culture, there's a lot of reason to say the sermons now move towards story, more towards conversation than they did towards lecture. And in the past, sermons were more like lectures than conversation. And that's what I'm trying to get at. So that when I listen to a good sermon, the thing that strikes you is not point one, point two, point three, point four. It's much more like a conversation. It has about it that element. And in conversation, somebody asked me why I talk about movements rather than points. I haven't gotten into that because that's a whole other area. But it's basically saying that if you think about how a conversation works, it works according to movements, not points. That is, two people talking to one another and have, you know, purpose in what they're doing. Don't sit there and structure things with Roman numerals and A's and B's. They make movements, and then within the movements they have moves, ways of developing it that are more like conversations, more like stories, more like drama than they are like lectures. And what you had out of Greco-Roman rhetoric is lecture. It's easier to do the lecture. You can still structure a sermon with Roman numerals and all the rest, but you've got to understand that people don't hear an outline. That's for your convenience to see how the thought is put together, but people don't hear outlines. Only in schools do they have outlines. In the real world, where people live and breathe and fall in love and die, they don't hear outlines. They don't want an outline on how to deal with grief. They want somebody to talk to them about grief. And if you talk to somebody about grief and what they'll experience, you move through the conversation. So the sense is that this person's talking with me, not at me. Good sermons are more like they have the element of conversation. I'm tempted, a lot of stuff I'd like to hit on that, but that's the change I see happening in our culture.
And no problems with moving from Roman numeral one, through the transitions to the next point. But back at the beginning, when you've stated your big idea, then you've got to state very soon thereafter the first major point. And I've got a bit of a hassle with getting from the big idea to the first major point, letting them be seen to be separate, but getting across that this is
before you can go from the statement of your idea to your first point, you must raise a question. Because having stated the idea, I have to either ask in some form or other, what's that mean? Or is that true? Do I really believe it? Or what difference does that make? Because if I have stated, coming out of my introduction, I've created a need and I state the idea completely, that answers my need. Okay? And having done that, now the question is there anything else to be said about it? So if I come out of an introduction which I have talked about people handling grief, and then I were to say, when grief is properly handled, it is really something that is passing, though it feels for all the world like it is permanent. I'm not talking about the sermon, but I suppose that was my idea. So I talk about somebody going through grief, talk about how they feel it, perhaps how I feel like a bumbling novice when I try to help, but I say, in essence, what this text says, if it were saying it, is that when we go through grief, it is really part of the passings, but it feels for all the world like the permanent. All right, I've answered my need. If I don't raise the question, what's that mean? What do you mean by that? Or if it was fairly clear, somebody says, oh, is that really true? Is it really part of the passing? Is that really true? Okay, but so what? What difference does that make? And those are the three functional questions. I have to raise some question, not in exactly those words, but some form of those questions before I can go on, because if I don't, the tension is gone. The answer is there. So you come out of your introduction and you orient, if you do to your idea. Then after you have stated that, you've got to raise another question or the sermon's over. Okay? That's a good question, because it often looks like you state the idea and then jump into point one. But the transition into point one is one of those, is a way of probing with a functional question. And hear me well, I'm not talking about using exactly the question, but some way you bring up what's involved in the question.
I just want to pick up on the idea of that conversation. You're saying that the flow of the ideas is in a conversational form. I know that in our group, and I'm the chief offender of this, but when I'm presenting, it's not like I'm in conversation. I go into a hyper mode, and I'm really over-exaggerating and being forceful. And I'm just wondering whether the style should then also be reflected by the conversational mode.
When we talk about conversation, we're not talking about what you do if you're sitting across the table from somebody else having coffee. We are saying that the delivery, for instance, what you're talking about, has the same elements of conversation. And when you are talking conversationally, there is a way in which you vary your pitch, your rate, your force. You don't think about it, you just do it. You're talking with people. What you may be referring to is the fact that often when preachers get to preaching, instead of talking with people, they talk at them. And so we are not interacting, even though it's a monologue. I'm not anticipating questions. That isn't involved. I'm delivering this load to you. We do that when we witness. Isn't he? Have a conversation with somebody, and Lord help him if he says, how do you get to heaven? I mean, from there on out, we boom, 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 and no questions asked. So there is that element about conversation delivery, but it's conversational delivery amplified and enlarged. Let me see if I can illustrate. Let's suppose, as we have had at the break, some of you have come up and asked some stimulating questions. So a couple of us are talking. And then before long, other people will come up and join in. Okay, and they want to hear what you're talking about. So I'm talking to Alan about something. And now there's maybe 10 people in the group. And so I will raise my voice a bit, not shouting at Alan, but I know that there are people back there that want to hear it. But let's suppose a bunch of you were to come out and suddenly we had 50 people standing around. I'm still talking to Alan and he's still talking to me, but somebody in the back of the group says, speak up, I want to hear you. Okay. I don't suddenly start shouting, Alan, you got to know this. I mean, even though I may talk louder, I am still talking with him and not at him, so that the person on the outside can hear it. That's the conversational tone. So what you're doing is amplifying. I might use larger gestures because I'm talking to him, but I want the people 5 rows, 10 rows away to be able to see. Okay. That's different than shouting because I am trying to somehow drive this like a pile driver into your head. So conversation is interactive. And in conversation, it is not unusual, if Alan has asked me a question, for me to take quite a segment of time in answering that. It doesn't mean that we have to have every 2 sentences back and forth, back and forth. But in preaching, I have to imagine that Alan is out there and that I'm talking with him, and if I can anticipate his question, I try to meet his question. There's a mood about that that's quite different. And so that's why I said a couple of times, if you think of yourself preparing a sermon or preaching a sermon, you're probably taking the wrong track to get to what you want to do. What you need to do is to think of yourself as talking with people about something that matters to them from the Scriptures. That's a different attitude than I'm now preaching a sermon. Because if you think of yourself preaching a sermon, if you come out of some traditions, that means you've got to hit a high level of volume and stay there. In our American Southeast, it means that you suck air a certain way. God loves you. God cares about you. You got to know that. Amen, brother. Hey, you know, and I don't know what they're doing, but that's not the way they order Cokes. That's not the way they talk to friends. In fact, if you were with 6 people and some guy did that to you, you'd send them off to the doctor. But in that tradition, that's what preaching was. I am arguing that in our day, for most people, when they come in out of the cold and they hear a guy sucking air yelling at them, you're not communicating with them. That's a long answer to a good short question. One more, yes.
Doing your applications, where do you do it?
All the way through.
All the way through.
It starts in the introduction when you raise a need. You're applying this in the sense you're raising. As you're developing it, if I frame my points in terms of you, if my first point is justification is an act of God, and I frame my point by saying, what God wants you to know is that this thing we call justification is something that God does for you. The framing of that point that way. As I'm developing it, either immediately I'm going to talk to you about some question you have, or I'm going to explain what I just meant. But I'm forced, if I frame the point in terms of the audience, to come back to the audience to say, you see, it matters. This is something God does for you. You don't have to do it for him, does it for you. Okay. The statement of the point makes me, as I'm interacting with the audience, talk to them. There's application there. It may not be the formal application, but it's there. Sometimes I apply as I go through. Sometimes as I am talking with an audience, I come to the end and in conclusion, trying to bring this to a burning focus. That's when I will suggest something you can do as a result of this. If you think of talking to the people in front of you about them, that is the, if that's what you're thinking, you will apply. If you have somebody that comes to your office and they are hurting or they've got questions, almost instinctively, you will try to explain this in terms they understand, illustrations that they know, and show that this makes some difference to them. You do it instinctively. Somehow when you get to a group of 100, you don't do it. So if you think of yourself talking with the audience about them from the Bible, you'll find yourself applying all the way through. Not in a sense of, now I'm going to put a little application, but you just obviously saying, you know, that you see what this means in your life. So it's a communicative mode, and because it's that application, as we normally talk about it, just permeates it. Well, I just wanted to say before you went to the regions beyond how much I've appreciated being here with you this week. I am deeply grateful to you for taking time from your busy schedules to be here. It would have been a bummer of a week if all the chairs had been empty. I also want to say what is the obvious, but I do not know what the future of Australia is for God. I do not know what the church will look like as it turns into the third millennium. But I do know this. If Australia is going to be reached for God in a significant way, in some part at least, it's going to be because of some of you sitting here today. And there can be times when you're in a small church and you are battling a board of deacons or somebody in the congregation, but you want to give up the fight. I understand that. Being the president of a seminary, it's great stuff on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, but every Tuesday and Thursday I think about quitting. But while you may at times lose that sense of your own significance, as we all do, immersed in the details of life, if Australia is going to be different for God, if this continent is going to be touched for Jesus Christ, if not you, who? Not now, when? And you need to know that. You need to hear that. You need to keep it in front of you. Put it on your mirror when you're shaving. That in some way, at least, what Christ is going to be in this continent depends on you and your ministry. That's a challenge to be a godly man. That's a challenge to be a man of the Scriptures. That's a challenge to be relevant. That's a challenge to think creatively. We have talked, Alan and I, about you, and I just mentioned the other day that I'd like to work with some of you in smaller groups. And that's no big deal. That's no big sacrifice. That would not be a big thing for me. If I thought that by working with you I could better serve Christ and touching Australia, that would be a tremendous investment in my life. Coming here this week, I feel that. If I have in some small way contributed to your ministry and your ministry contributes to Christ's cause in this continent, then I am well repaid. A long time ago when I was a young man, I made that commitment to Jesus Christ. And, man, I mean, you're worth the investment. You're somebody. You really are. And if you don't do it, it's not going to get done. And so I'm very grateful for the opportunity that has been afforded me and the warmth that you have shown me, the sense of your hospitality. I said to several people that in the United States, I think it's accurate that probably Australia is the favorite country of Americans. They don't know a whole lot about you. I mean, if they did, they probably changed their mind. But it goes back to World War II when servicemen who were hurt in the Pacific were brought here and your hospitals took care of them. It goes to such silly things as Qantas Airlines and Koala Bears. It goes to Crocodile Dundee, who is a man on the film who is sort of without guile but shrewd enough to handle the city. I mean, all of that. You come to the United States, if I were you, I'd practice your Australian every day. People respond warmly to Australians. There's a sense we share a common spirit. A lot of things we have in common. And my being here twice has not changed that point of view. In the words of Isaiah the prophet, you're a great bunch.